Set your course for the Hoth system. General Veers, prepare your men.
All troops will debark for ground assault. Prepare to target the main generator.
Echo Station 3TA.
On an Imperial Walker.
Attack pattern Delta. Go now. Watch that clock fire, boys. Right now, I feel like I could take on the whole Empire myself.
Target, maximum firepower.
Imperial troops have entered the bay.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Echo Base. This is episode number 138, recording this on March 26, 2018. We're missing a man tonight, Tim. So it's just you and I with a couple guests. Eric could not be here with us. So according to random chatter policy, anything that goes wrong will be Eric's fault.
All his fault.
Exactly. Exactly. So feel free to blame Eric for anything. You know, if something happens in the news while we're recording tonight, we can blame Eric for that. You know, any of that stuff is fine. That's mm-hmm. just how we roll.
Technology failure, Eric's fault.
There you go.
Cat jumping on Lou's audio equipment, Eric's fault.
If the laws of gravity fail for some reason, Eric's fault. Yep.
Yeah.
So Tim, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good, Lou. I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm doing good. Spring is finally here. It feels like spring here in Echo Base, down south at least.
I still can measure some snow and feet here. So
really? Wow. Okay.
Well, I have the weird dynamic of big piles of snow, grass. Big piles of snow, grass.
Yeah, we don't have any more big piles of snow down here in the southern end of Echo Base. We're pretty much clear. It's just mud season now. So that's good. As I mentioned, we have a couple hosts with us tonight, or a couple guests with us tonight.
Or guest hosts.
That's true. They could be guest hosts.
The two words.
Like that. Yeah. How about a host guest?
That sounds like a disaster, actually. Just you don't know what you're doing. Just host it. Go ahead.
Okay, so the first voice you hear, that was Nikki. Nikki, how are you tonight?
Oh, I'm doing just fine.
Awesome. Yeah. Tell everybody about a little bit about where you're coming to us from and what your connections are here.
I'm coming from Columbia, South Carolina. Tim actually knows me from Twitter, and I like to comment a lot about different Star Wars things. And
nice.
I did a audio recording a few weeks ago of just trying my hand at kind of like an audiobook recording type thing. And he's like, oh, you've got a great voice. Come on. And I'm sure my wonderful nonstop tweeting about Star Wars in particular probably led me to be maybe a interesting.
Yeah, I think you had the one really in with Tim, and that was with Thrawn. So, If you mention Thrawn with Tim, you're good. If you mention Porgs, forget about it. He'll disown you. He'll unfollow you. It's just you're gone.
We're close then, because I'm not into I don't get the Porg thing either. So,
yeah, neither do I actually. Now, the only thing is, if you mention Porg recipes, he's okay with that.
Yeah.
Oh yeah,
I'm gonna do some kind of Porg. You know, roasting on my big green egg this year, I think. So I'll try something out. Our other guest with us tonight is a longtime listener. Josh, how are you tonight?
Hi, this is Josh. First time, long time.
There we go. Okay, we hear you now.
Yeah. No, I'm really hoping that I don't just like fall off of this because I'm hearing everybody in pieces. So it might be a fun night for me. Who knows?
Uh-oh. All the wonders of Skype.
Yeah,
we'll get through it.
We will. Okay, well, let's get right into the news. Is there any other network news we have to talk about, Tim? I totally forgot about that. Do we have anything new coming up that we want to? I mean, new show wise, we have the Tight Beam coming out for Expanse. We have episode one, I think, is being released this week.
Yep.
So that'll be fun in advance of the April 11th premiere of season 3. Tim, your new show, is that debuted yet?
Which one, Dispatches or the MCU show?
Dispatches.
Episode one has been edited and should be posted here in the next day or two, I would imagine. So we're excited about that. If anyone here is a fan of Band of Brothers, or if you haven't watched it, great opportunity now to watch it. Pick it up on HBO, HBO Now, which you can get for free for like 3 months, which is definitely good enough to watch the 10 episodes of Band of Brothers. You can get also on Amazon Prime. You could go out and buy the discs if you really want. It's actually well worth it. So you can kind of watch along with us. Good times.
Nice. Nice. Okay, let's get right into the show then. We have some news, unlike last week where we didn't really have any news.
The last like 2 or 3 weeks have been like barren of freaking Star Wars news. And then all of a sudden, boom, this week we have news.
Well, of course, that's the way it always works. So first up, we have an interesting news about some gaming stuff. We were kind of dismayed a few months back when EA closed down Visceral Games and there was no more Star Wars open world type content coming. And now it appears maybe there is. EA Vancouver's page has posted a job posting for someone, see what they term it as, to lead a team to deliver online features for a Star Wars open world project, ensure designs, and will maintain a high traffic services for multi-platform games. That sounds pretty awesome to me.
I think so. My question, what exactly are they meaning by open world?
Open worlds where you're not, you know, it's not on rails. You're not following specific missions. You can go kind of anywhere you want to and do whatever you want to.
So are they looking at this to be an MMO?
That's what it sounds like. That's what I mean. They're saying the job posting kind of points towards things to make it like Destiny, which is an open world game. You know, you got tasks you can do certainly in an area. You can go almost anywhere. You still got to go to certain areas to get the job done. You can't just go like over here instead of a house. But, you know, it is more open world than some other stuff. You know, I think that they've kind of fallen off the deep end with what they've done lately with gaming. I mean, I don't know what you guys think about games, but there hasn't been a lot out there that's been really compelling to play. Battlefront 2 has been kind of a flop. We have some of that in the news a little bit later on as well. I didn't even pick up Battlefront 2 this time around. What are your thoughts on this kind of stuff?
Josh, what do you think? I know you're a pretty big gamer.
Well, I'm excited if they're going to do an open world game. I did buy Battlefront 2 and I've enjoyed it and we can get to that soon. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's been a while since I had something Star Wars, something gaming related that I could really sink my teeth into. The last thing that I played nonstop was The Old Republic, which I played that for about 2 years, and I was very active up until a certain point. But yeah, there hasn't really been an open world Star Wars game, and there's been, at least that I've had interest in, there's been very few open world games recently. The last open world game that I played, I played Destiny 2, but when I think of real open world, I think of something like Final Fantasy 15, where you could spend, you know, 30 to 40 hours and still be doing side quests and stuff before you even get to the main plot. You know, that's something I'm interested in doing again. So if this is going to open up and if it's Star Wars related, then I'm excited. You know, I'll see what happens from there.
Did you guys play Star Wars Galaxies 2001, 2002-ish?
No.
I did not.
I was a youngling.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm still at the temple. Still at the temple.
Tim, we're showing our age now. Yeah, you know, I knew some people that played it, and they loved it because it was really open world, and you could do anything you wanted to in the game. I never got into it, though. It was kind of before I was really into that kind of gaming.
I played it for probably a year and a half or so. It was good. The big issue was their servers, because if you got into real populated areas, particularly the popular areas, so like Mos Eisley, hugely populated, a crap ton of players would be in there, and to simply get across the city was so laggy, it would take like an hour and a half just to get across the city. And because they would have, like, you could see everyone's speech bubbles as players were chatting with each other. So of course that bogged down the server. You have a ton of players moving. It was also a spawn area. So when you would join the game, you had new players spawning in there. So the server just got horribly bogged down. Yet that was where a lot of quests started. That's where you could buy a lot of stuff. That's where there was so much going on. And it was, yeah, it was bad just to like traverse across that city. Like you would just set your character on run, set the direction, go walk away and do something like go watch a Star Wars movie and then come back and you would just be getting out of the city. It was, that was really rough.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people had complaints about that. Their servers just simply weren't able to deal with it. But once you got out of the area, it was terrific. It was just like playing Old Republic or something like that. You're generally out in the wilderness. You get to, you know, kill some womp rats. You get to build a hut. You get to, you know, do whatever you want to. And it was pretty cool. It was a lot of fun.
Nice. I mean, for me, I want something with a storyline to it. I want to have content where I can unearth the story as we go along, find new things, and yeah, do my own thing when I want to. But there's got to be some story content to it. That's why the two Battlefront games really didn't intrigue me as much, because it was more of a first-person shooter in a lot of ways. There wasn't a lot of other stuff to do in it. But, I mean, and it's fun, too. It's just not what I'm looking for all the time. Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of Battlefront 2, I guess DICE is making a change again to the way they're doing this. And Josh, feel free to chime in here, because I know you play the game and you probably spend a lot more time in this than I have, since I don't own Battlefront 2. But there was a story we covered maybe 6 months ago about how it was just a grind to unlock characters like Luke or the ships you wanted to play. And you could pay for things. And, you know, I'm not willing to pay for microtransactions after a certain point. I mean, I might do a little bit here and there, but, you know, I personally don't want to spend another $100 on a game after I've already paid for the game. Now they're unlocking everything, every hero, every ship, I guess in the arcade modes for the game. So you can at least try this stuff out and play with it and then try to gain it back in the game if you want to. Josh, what's your take on this whole thing now?
I've not played Battlefront for a couple months now because other things came out. I've been playing Monster Hunter World, and just my time priorities have gone other places. But when I was playing Battlefront, I enjoyed the gameplay. One thing that I have to say this Battlefront has over the 2015 Battlefront was it felt more like the original Battlefront. The class systems were there. The heroes were significantly more balanced than in the 2015 Battlefront. The environments looked great. You know, there was a campaign, and it was a decent campaign. You know, my only complaint about it was the Iden Versio story was just too short, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it was an average game, you know, it hit everything and it's Star Wars. So I'm going to enjoy it. But when it came to the progression, it was, even when they took out the microtransactions thing, your rewards per match did not equal what is necessary to be upgrading gear or unlocking gear and stuff like that. And so, I mean, it's so hard to unlock characters. It made it so hard to upgrade abilities. And, you know, you'd play the game and you'd see people who have max level abilities and have all these things. And it's either, well, you spent a lot of money the first week the game was out, or you have only been playing this game, you know, for X number of days. And so, it really made it hard to enjoy it if you wanted to play everybody at an even level. And so,
sure. Mm-hmm. I don't fault games for making you grind a little bit to get to where you want to be. There should be a little bit
totally
of that. It's like paying your dues. You have to, but not to the point where everybody was saying this game was at.
I think I spent like 3 hours one day playing. So I was like, hey, you know what? Let me do some Battlefront. They had, I believe, 3 or 4 different loot boxes that you can get in the game. You could purchase them with in-game credit, and they would give you star cards for heroes, ships, and individual troopers. If you got replicas, they would give you credit for replicas and so on and so forth. I always went for the hero boxes. It was about, you know, 2,400 credits. I can get abilities for all of the class types. But at the end of every round for 3 hours, I was getting about less than 100 credits per game.
Sure.
And
that's rough. That's a lot of grinding. That takes you a long time. That's exhausting.
Right.
Yeah. And even if you wanted to unlock unlock abilities, you can unlock abilities for something like 40 or 50 crafting parts, which is not bad. And it doubles every time you want to upgrade that same ability. But I was getting like 7 or 8 crafting parts per round. Yeah. And so it was extremely tedious. And so I'd play it every now and then, you know, just to say, hey, you know what? I want to play some Battlefront, but I could never be one of those people who, you know, is going to commit themselves
right
to playing Battlefront for 6 or 7 hours like people on Twitch are streaming. That's not me. That's a commitment
is a lot. Yeah. Now, the change that they're making, it sounds like, is this going to bring you back? Will you want to go back and try this if they're going to unlock everything?
I have a couple games that I'm on hold of right now because there's a little bit of a content drought. Battlefront is one of them. They had something, I think it was like last weekend, where they unlocked a game mode that was like just using jetpacks and grenade launchers, and I was disappointed I didn't get to play it because that just sounds like it's fun. I'll come back when they do the continuation of the Iden Versio campaign.
Yeah.
Which I expect they'll do that in May with Han Solo. It's a shame that it's taking so long. But yeah, I'll try it out, and if I enjoy it, it'll be something that I can, you know, come home from work one day and say, you know what, I don't have a lot of, you know, time left for my day. Maybe just play a couple of rounds of Battlefront.
Sure. Now, Nikki, we don't mean to ignore you. You're not a big gamer, right?
No, I'm not. Even like I'll download something for my phone, and within 5 minutes I'm bored. Just, I'm great that there's ways that people who do like games can, you know, get their content and their way to experience the fandom. But yeah, that's just no. Yep. If it's not like a Bejeweled type game.
So grinding for 6 hours at a time to get minimal reward is probably not up your alley.
Oh, no, but, you know, I mean.
It's not a mine either, believe me. That's why I'm playing that.
Oh, yeah.
Is controversy more your thing? We never have controversy in Star Wars, so I think we bring this one up because it's just so far and few in between. Yes. Tim, I don't know where you found this from, tell you the truth. Comicbook.com has it, I guess, the story about Lucasfilm losing a lawsuit, mm-hmm. which is kind of weird because you don't really think about that happening too much. And of course, I've got Tim's ad here with noise in here. I can't hear myself think. sorry, Tim.
My ad.
Well, ad note that you gave me here. So now I didn't quite follow this whole story, Tim. So why don't you take us through this? Lucasfilm was suing somebody over a convention movie they were making.
Yeah. So there's a guy in the I believe he's in the UK. Mark John is his name, and he did some footage from a convention that was over there back in December 2015.
But it was his convention, right? I mean, he was the one running this.
I think so.
Okay.
I think so. And he also had in there an interview with David Prowse, which for people who might not know, first of all, David Prowse played Darth Vader in the original trilogy. And he also kind of became persona non grata with Lucasfilm. He was pretty critical, like to the point of being really, really vocally critical of mm-hmm. some of the choices that Lucasfilm made. He didn't like the fact that they dubbed over his voice. He didn't like the fact that some of the things that they did in the special editions.
He didn't like the fact that he didn't get to play the scene where Darth Vader was unmasked.
Yes, yeah. So there were a number of things that he kind of complained about, and over time became vocal enough that either George himself, because this occurred back when George was still steering the ship, or one of George's lieutenants said, "All right, David, you want to play hardball? You're out, buddy. You're done. It's all over." And so Prowse has still been doing the convention circuit, but pretty much not really associated with anything that has to do with Lucasfilm. So this guy, anyway, did really what amounts to a documentary of the con itself, and it included this interview with David Prowse. And in the UK, he, I guess, made some sort of arrangement with theaters to screen this ahead of The Force Awakens. And I don't know if he was charging separately for this or he was getting some basically kickbacks from the theaters or whatever the arrangement was there that he was going to be doing. Lucasfilm found out about it. They filed an injunction. They said, you know, basically you can't do this. If it has to do with Star Wars, it's our property. And we definitely don't want you doing this. We don't want you screening this ahead of brand new movie, which we haven't had a movie in several years.
Right. And just to be clear, it says that this was being set to be broadcast on 1200 screens shortly before the release of The Force Awakens. So it wasn't going to be, before the movie, like a trailer. Something was going to be a couple of weeks before the movie was released.
Okay. Yep.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that's almost worse because that gives all of those ideas even more time to stew. If you're interviewing people that are critical of the direction that Lucasfilm has gone, that colors it quite a bit.
I mean, the David Prowse saga has been going on for a long time, and we've talked about it before on the show. And, I personally don't have anything against the guy, but I also don't see his whole beef with everything. There's been a lot of stuff that Lucas did in the movies over the years where he would change a voice or change this or cut somebody out of the movie. That's just part of being in Hollywood, right? I mean, you might film a scene and end up on a cutting room floor and never make the movie.
Mm-hmm.
He was the guy in the costume, sure. And, his big thing was that, nobody could have done it like I did it. And I'm like, well, okay. I don't think that's really the case, personally. I mean, you can put a lot of people in the suit and, you've got to know how to act. But you know what? I mean, they've put somebody else in Chewbacca's suit now. So,
yeah,
that seemed to work out okay. I mean, I don't see the big deal. But now to do a documentary on David Prowse, I mean, you're just looking to raise the eyebrows of Lucasfilm and have them come after you.
True. And so basically what happened here was the guy said, well, you guys blocked me from being able to run this. I stood to make some money. He thought he could have made $1 million off of it. Lucasfilm laughed and said, no, there's no way you could have made that. The court system actually did find in favor of him and ordered Lucasfilm to pay him $56,000, which is not a lot of money.
They found that in the cushions of the couch at the lunchroom of Lucasfilm.
Pretty much. I think, at least to me, and this is a discussion, we probably should have brought Tom in too to co-host with us. My guess here is that because this was a documentary, documentaries are kind of fair game. I mean, even though, yes, you still have to pay attention to copyrights and that kind of thing, but a documentary is not taking that license. It's talking about that license.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm guessing that's why the court ruled in his favor over Lucasfilm, but they did seem to agree with Lucasfilm that he probably wasn't going to make that much money off of it.
Yeah, that's instead of being on 1,200 screens, I guess the courts took the opinion that it would only be on about 150 screens, so much less profit than he would have made normally. But I don't know. I mean, I think it's newsworthy because it talks about the David Prowse thing, and he hasn't come up in topic in a long time. He's kind of become irrelevant. Now he's back in the spotlight again with this, but I don't know.
Any thoughts that you guys have on any of this?
Yeah, well, he got paid to advertise his own documentary.
Pretty much, that sounds
like a good day.
Well, and I have to imagine that now that it's gotten some press, I remember reading about this a few months ago, and then now we have this article here. Yeah, the guy's basically getting free advertising. And I have to imagine some people are going to want to talk to him about it, and they're probably going to want to see it.
Yeah. Not even free advertising. He got paid.
Yeah.
It's only advertising right. Where someone pays you.
Yeah.
I wonder if this will be available to stream at some point. More than likely. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Where are we at now, Tim? I lost track of where we were. Speaking of controversy one more time, Lord and Miller, the two guys that were doing the Solo movie before things went off the rails in that movie, There was a lot of talk before we discussed this about who's going to get credit for directing, if they're going to be co-directors listed, there's certain rules that the Movie Picture Association has to follow in terms of, you know, the courts and the unions for as who gets credit for what. And I guess this has been kind of all doped out now. Lord and Miller are going to get executive producer credits on the movie and not director credits. Ron Howard's be the only director listed for the movie. And I guess we go our separate ways then. So I don't know if Lord Miller are going to get any more money out of this because of getting an EP credit, but I'm kind of happy with the way this ended up. I don't think they should have gotten much out of this as far as credit goes for the movie, because it sounds like everything they did, they kind of trashed.
Yeah. It's, I guess it seems right that they should get something. And even in the article, why did his name just leave me? The new director,
Ron Howard.
Ron Howard, thank you. You know, Howard even mentions that, hey, you know, their fingerprints are still all over this.
Hmm.
And, you know, Howard didn't have to recreate the film. He still used a lot of their footage and a lot of their ideas and their concepts. So I think it is good that these guys are getting some kind of credit. To have an executive producer credit, I think they're just kind of taking some liberty in terms of what that actually means. You know, I'm sure there's probably some debate of, well, you know, gee, do we give them a writer's credit? Well, the writers union probably didn't like that. Mm-hmm. There are particular rules in Hollywood for how you get a director's credit. So they weren't able to do that because Howard did end up directing a significant part of the film that precluded what Lord Miller did. So I don't really think there are particular rules in terms of who you name to be an executive producer. So I think they just kind of threw him a bone and said, yeah, here you go. Your name can be on the movie too. Yeah, and I don't mean to disregard what they did. It's just trying to find a place to put them in that stream of credits.
It seems like anybody can have a producer or an EP credit in movies. Yeah. It's almost like it's throwing people a bone. Here you go. You know, here's an executive producer credit for yourself. And you're right. I mean, there's so much of the movie was reshot. I mean, what they're saying that they think about 80% of the movie was reshot.
Oof.
That's so rough. I mean, that is a huge amount. And 20% is really background stuff almost. I mean, that's almost, you know, second unit stuff when you come right down to it.
Yeah.
So I'm still nervous about what this movie is going to be produced on screen and what we're going to get and how disjointed it's going to be. I mean, Ron Howard can do a lot of things, and he's has work cut out for him trying to pull this together in a short amount of time. I forget when he took over the directing of the movie, but it was very late in the process. Josh, any thoughts on this?
No, I mean, you know, I typically look at the solo film. Actually, I quote you when I think of the solo film, where it's not really the film I want, but it's the film I'm going to get, and so I'm going to enjoy it.
There you go. So,
you know, we'll see. And you know what? Whatever style that Lord and Miller were attempting with Han Solo, I mean, I think we can all agree it wasn't something that might have been resonating with what the projected idea was for Solo. I can only say this after seeing one film that they made, and that was the Lego film, which was a great film, and it was awesome. But that same level of filmmaking would not have fit in any type of Star Wars film, in my opinion. I mean, I could be wrong, but
I mean, I could see it maybe being in a Star Wars film, but just not this one. You know, I mean, you could make a comedy of sorts, I suppose. I mean, we'd have to kind of make sure that we all know what it's going to be like well before we get to it, not, you know, something we've been dying or somebody we've been dying to see is a solo movie. I mean, you can't just do it there and change the whole format and the way we're used to seeing these movies. I think that'd be a disaster.
No, I agree. And I think, you know, it's one of those, well, if they were going to have a character film, who would they want to have these directors for? You know, you could only do it with so many characters that might hit that same level of humor and seriousness at the same time, you know, and it would be someone like Han. It would be someone like Lando, you know, well, at least
there could be that Jar Jar movie that Tim's been waiting for. So, you know, Jar Jar and the Porgs, maybe. No, Nikki, we haven't heard from you on this. Is this a movie you really looking forward to? I mean, have you been dying to see this whole movie?
Me? Not necessarily. You know, it's when they announced it, I was just like, oh, okay. Like, you know, I could probably think of a lot of other character studies that would have proved to be, and you do have a Jar Jar. Look at that. I am more than willing to give anything a shot. You know, I don't like going into things with prejudices.
Fair enough.
But yeah.
You know, it's funny. Most people I've talked to have had similar comments to yours of, and like Josh said too, it's like, yeah, okay. You know, it's like, I couldn't say I heard the movie come out. I'm like, yes, I just can't wait for it. No, it's not what I want. I mean, Rogue One, I was like, yeah, that's what I want.
Yeah. I feel like there needs to be more Rogue Ones, but I mean, What more, you know, tiny snippets of background things can you explore to that, you know?
It's true.
Depth. But, yeah, I mean, who knows? Again, just try not to be too, I know a lot of people on Twitter or Tumblr, you know, are like, oh, this isn't the movie anyone wanted. And no, I'll give it its chance. I'll see what it has to do.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to make its $400 or $500 million at the box office. So Disney will say, see, we told you guys wanted this. Oh, yeah. Boy. Now, are you guys like me? Have you guys all bought multiple copies of the movies? I mean, I mean, I'm older than most people listening here even. But, you know, I've had VHS. I had the widescreen VHS. I had DVDs and Blu-rays. And, you know, I've bought the movie more times than I care to admit to.
Yeah, especially the original trilogy.
Okay, so Tim's in the same boat. Josh and Nikki, are you guys in the same boat? You guys own multiple copies of the movie? Have purchased at least more than once?
Go ahead, Nikki.
Yeah, I will have to say that, like, I am from the era where the special editions were the only real versions of the movies that you can get. Mm-hmm. And my husband actually recently acquired a despecialized version of the original trilogy. And I was all like, oh, this will be great. Everyone complains about the special edition. And like watching the attack on the Death Star from the original, you're like, oh, this was exciting. Like,
and you're telling yourself, this was state of the art.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, some of the stuff you don't realize was, you know, added. Like, I just figured it was like the horrible, you know, computer generated Jabba. But yeah, I mean, even the battles were different. So, but as for different like mediums, I guess I'm a person of my generation. I have almost everything on my phone. So like, okay. I will seriously just sit down and be like, you know what? I've got some time to spare. I'm just going to watch this one scene and like, just pull it up, scroll through real fast and be like, cool, I'm going to watch this. So most of my stuff is just like, you know, like a download that I have, I can watch through real quick.
Okay.
My fingertips. I travel, so like you just, you know, everything that I have, I want to have real small with me.
You know, that gives a whole new meaning to, remember the ads that came out for the special editions, Tim? They said, for generations, you've only seen the movie like this. And they had a little TV screen in the middle of the big movie screen.
Yeah.
And it widened down. I think to myself, next one's going to be, for years, you've only seen it like this. And somebody else watching a little phone somewhere. Completely different experience. I'm not calling you out on that, but it's just a completely different experience.
It's good.
Yep. Josh, yep. What about you? Do you have multiple copies of the movies right now?
Well, I have. Okay, so I remember my parents having at least a special edition copy. I have the, God, is it 2004 or 2006 widescreen limited edition of the original trilogy? which is my favorite way to watch the original trilogy. Because I also have the Blu-ray of all six films, the quote unquote mm-hmm. complete.
Yep.
And it's, I don't agree with some of the changes that they made. That was the first time where I was like, oh, now I understand how original trilogy fans, you know, feel when there's like changes to the background.
You made a
like,
change to what you thought was the movie. Yeah.
Like I think, well, okay. I know Eric dislikes Yoda to the millionth degree. But I explicitly remember him saying he hated the Yoda puppet in episode one. And that was the one I grew up with as a kid. I like the Yoda puppet in episode one, but the Blu-ray doesn't have it. The Blu-ray has the new CG one, and so then it like throws me off when I'm watching the film. But yeah, I've had multiple copies, okay. Multiple versions. I think I had episodes one and two on VHS, and episode three, and then the limited edition trilogy were the first DVD versions of that I have. So now I always get like whatever it is, DVD, Blu-ray, digital, deluxe versions of everything. So
there you go. Well, the reason why I ask is because now we're going to have a chance to do another form of Star Wars in multiple copies. Because I own most of the movies soundtracks on either CD or download. And now they're remastering all the movies from the first, or all the soundtracks from the first six movies one more time, making little tweaks and letting us buy it one more time. I don't even know. I mean, Tim, are you going to pony up for another set of soundtracks?
No.
I mean, I purchased...
It's nothing I feel compelled to do.
When they remastered the original trilogy soundtracks, they had a complete set, three movies, two discs per movie, extra sound, special packaging, all this stuff. I got sucked in and bought that. And I was like, okay, really good. Do I need to buy it again? I don't think I'm going to. I mean, I just don't get why they're spending the time and effort to go through and remastering all six soundtracks one more time.
I mean, it's obviously incredible music, and a lot of it is really iconic, and it's just amazing to listen to. I mean, it's not something I listen to all the time, but I actually do have some of the songs, and you know, I have a Star Wars playlist. I guess, you know, periodically every number of years, someone at Lucasfilm says, you know what? We haven't made enough money off of this particular thing in a while. Let's re-release it. And we're going to, you know, make a bunch of sales. And that's fair. That's fine. I often bring up economics into our podcast, and all this stuff essentially comes down to money.
If they don't make money, we're not going to get any more of it. Absolutely. Yeah,
fundamentally, there is nothing else going on here except money making. That's what it is.
But I'd rather see them spend time and effort on something new than remastering and tweaking a couple tracks on the original soundtracks one more time.
But then you have to take into consideration, too, they're probably banking on the new fans coming in. I mean, I've met friends who have never watched the original trilogy, never watched the prequel trilogy, and they literally came in, you know, Force Awakens. So yeah, they're actually new to this entire world. Yeah. So for them, they might be like, oh, cool, I didn't know I could buy this, you know?
Yeah, that's fair.
Okay. I guess that works.
And I think there's another argument. I do all of my Star Wars listening on Spotify.
Okay.
Almost everything is there. Mm-hmm. At least the last three films, whole albums are there. Over the past two or three years, they've been pulling tracks out of the previously remastered versions on Spotify. And so there's things like The Burning Homestead, I think, that I can't find on Spotify now, which sucks. It's a great track. It's an iconic track. But there are tracks in the original albums that are not played in the film. And so I'm sure that part of it is bringing awareness to these moments in the album that are reflected in the film, but are reflected without the orchestrated music. One of the scenes that comes to mind is the arena on Geonosis. A lot of that doesn't have any music, but if you look in the episode 2 soundtrack, there's tons of music that's there, you know, and episode 2 gets a lot of flack for having one continuous track on loop for 2.5 hours laid over with a bunch of tracks from The Phantom Menace, which I still think it's a great album. I understand all the complaints, but there are sort of these uniquenesses that are found throughout that album. And there's that first scene in episode 7 that you see Rey, that she opens up the compartment on the Star Destroyer. That has a ton of music. It's called The Scavenger, and one of my favorite tracks from that album. But yeah, so I'm sure that's part of it, you know. I would say I would love it if they did this for, or rather, I would have liked if they waited until maybe after episode 9, assuming that John Williams, as he says, he's going to do it and not going to do it, and, you know, maybe they can just wait.
Well, you know, this way here, they can do it after episode 9 and remaster all 9 movies one more time again.
And then they
and charge you one more time for everything. Because you got to have the boxes that all look alike, right? You got to, oh, it's the same packaging. So, yeah.
Well, you know, they can do that with Kevin Kiner now, because there's no Rebels, there's no Clone Wars. They can do a remaster of all his stuff.
True. That needs to be released. Season 4 had such a beautiful soundtrack.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really did. There was a lot of Kevin Kiner's stuff was really, really incredible. I mean, probably like the best one out of all of it was, oh gosh, the one where they were looking for the
journey to the star cluster for the Lasat planet.
For the Lasat planet, yes. Yeah,
journey to the star cluster.
That one is absolutely amazing.
Yep.
And it's like, it's mind blowing. It's totally mind blowing.
And even for that episode, it seemed to like come out of nowhere. Like Kevin Kiner was really putting down his best work for that one, you know, and it was like, what, like 3 minutes of the whole episode.
Oh yeah. So, yeah. You know,
that was incredible.
Truly.
Well, one last news story before we get into our discussion for the week. For those who were anticipating we'd get more out of who Laura Santeca was in the films and were disappointed, we have a possible solution for you. If you're reading the comics, Poe Dameron number 25 does get into a little bit of the background of who Laura Santeca was and what his role is going to be, or what his role was leading up to The Force Awakens. I'm not going to go into any spoilers. They don't give a lot away in the story. They do give some, but Screen Rant had an article about this. If you're doing the comics, though, number 25, I'm not there yet myself, so I will wait and read it when I get to it. But I'm glad they're finally getting some detail on the character that was probably supposed to be pretty important. I mean, he was on screen for all, what, about 2 minutes?
Yeah, that's probably about it.
But, you know, he was clearly involved, and I'd like to know more about him. So if they do it in comic form, I'm all over that.
Yeah, I think it could be interesting. I'm some people know I'm not a huge fan of Poe. Not that he's a bad character. I really don't like the evolution of the character, particularly in the films. I don't like what they did with him in The Last Jedi. They're just putting him down a path that is not great, and it's very not military. For someone who is supposed to be very military, to be very military. So
they actually said that better in the novelization. I thought it played a little bit better than the movie did.
Was it? Okay.
Yep. I mean, not much different. I mean, there's still the whole, you know, you're supposed to be following orders type thing, but
yeah.
It was talked about with more detail.
Okay.
So I was more comfortable with it after I read that than I was after watching the movie.
Okay. I still haven't picked up the novelization yet, but it seems there's a number of compelling reasons to read it, and I do look forward to it. But Laura Santeca was kind of this mystery because, you know, he appears right in the beginning of the film, and you know there's a deeper story there. Obviously, Poe knew him. He was tracking him down. Laura Santeca had this information on how to find Luke, how to find this this old Jedi temple. how did he get it? Where did it come from? Who is he? Where did he come from?
He knows Leia. I mean, you know, there's all these tie-ins. Yeah. You're like, God, who is this guy?
Yeah. Is he a Jedi? Is he not a Jedi? So yeah, all these different questions. And I mean, really, to be honest, just from the article that I read here from Screen Rant, they pretty much revealed most of that. So I don't have to pick up the comic.
Yeah, I just kind of dove into the beginning of the article. I didn't read through it because I didn't want to spoil all of it for myself. So
yeah, and I don't want to spoil it for any of our listeners. But yeah, Poe Dameron 25. If you're looking for some information on Laura San Tekka and some of his background, it should be worth picking up. It looks to be pretty interesting.
Okay, so now our discussion. One of these topics is going to make Tim exceedingly happy. And I think Nikki, too, she's a huge fan as well. Mm-hmm. So we're getting a new Thrawn novel this summer, right? Is it June? Is that the release
July.
Date?
July. It was moved to July, yeah.
Now, I don't mind. Why was it moved to July? He had a copy of the book at New York Comic Con last year. He held it up. He's like, here, this is it. We're going, what?
It was actually a history of economics in medieval France with just, you know, a dust cover over it.
Just put a dust cover on.
Don't burst my bubble. Come on. So we're getting the Thrawn novel this summer. Mm-hmm. And this is a team up. It's a buddy cop movie between Thrawn and Vader, right? Josh is shaking his head. No, Lou, no, you're wrong.
Just because I remember the last buddy cop book and it was Tarkin, and there was a lot of Vader like this close to killing Tarkin through half the book.
it should prove to be a real interesting story, because there obviously is, even just from a little bit of an excerpt that they released, there's some measure of animosity between Thrawn and Vader. And it'll be interesting to see the dynamic as they're out on this mission together. I'm putting this in terms of our known Rebels timeline, to the point where the Emperor had called for Thrawn to talk about the TIE Defender program and recall them. Does that seem to be... Or is this earlier after Thrawn killed the Bendu?
Yeah, I'm saying it's right before season four starts, because you see, we go into season four and he's like, I don't know. I mean, granted, in Through Imperial Eyes, he throws out the name Rook, but, you know, you've got to develop a whole relationship between Thrawn and Rook. Thank God he will no longer do anything artistic. Leon was name dropped, so we've got to bring him in.
Which I'm very excited about.
Oh yeah.
And I hope that he didn't.
Easter egg.
Yeah, I'm really hopeful that Paelian did not get killed off at the end of Rebels.
We don't know what
happened.
Yeah, according to Dave Filoni, they all survive. They're all somewhere.
Good.
And they're all fine. The Purgle took care of them, I guess. I think this is pretty much right after season three ends.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure, like, I mean, Thrawn's got to call back to the Emperor and be like, you know, those Rebels, they got away. There was some crazy force moose that, you know, told me I was going to fail, and I shot it in the face. And I don't know, somewhere in between there, this, you know, everything fell apart. You know, like, obviously at that point, the Emperor's like, come back to Coruscant. We're going to talk. And because they're name dropping, you know, like what happened on Adelon. I think if it took place in season four, we'd be talking more about Lothal at that point.
Okay. Yep. No, that's fair enough. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in between all of these seasons, we never have a clear timeline on how long is in between. So seems like a perfect time to have a filler. Like, hey, book, we're going on a journey. Come back.
You know, the one thing I don't get, maybe you guys can answer this for me. I don't get how, you know, the Emperor has always seemed like a pretty unforgiving guy when it comes to failing him.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, Vader's failed him a couple times. Mm-hmm. And now it seems like Thrawn's failed him too. So, you know, he doesn't get rid of these guys. Why is he so forgiving for these two?
Probably because he painted himself in a corner, you know? Some people are replaceable, like it even says in the excerpt, but you know, how are you going to replace Thrawn? He didn't exactly mess up. He didn't exactly fail. There were things out of his control.
Oh, he didn't get the job done.
Vader, who else is he going to find? You know, he created Vader, and Vader is his, like, creation. So I think he just kind of lets some of these things slide until it, you know, I don't.
Well, I do kind of think that Vader is the monster to Palpatine's Frankenstein, but and I mean, he needs Vader. If nothing else, he needs Vader to be that symbol, you know, out in the galaxy where, you know, Palpatine's going to stay in his throne room, and he's going to do everything via proxy, and that proxy is Vader.
Right.
Much to, you know, Tim's dismay, I know close to nothing about Thrawn. And I've yet to read the Thrawn novel. I've yet to read even my Heir to the Empire, which I got signed by Timothy Zahn a couple years ago.
Nice. Wow.
It was at New York Comic Con, too. But I mean, from everything I know of Thrawn, he seems to be like this singularity in the Empire. So whatever sort of sway he has with the Palpatine, Jesus, he has with our buddy Sheev, it's got to be something substantial. You know, there's got to be something that Palpatine sees as, if nothing else, probably the best military leader in the Empire, because we know Tarkin knows a lot more than Tarkin gives off, and you know, there is sort of this odd triumvirate of the Emperor, Vader, and Tarkin that goes on throughout the Empire. Mm-hmm. And Tarkin's also technically not a military leader. Right. He's a Moff. He is, you know, the governor of the Outer Rim. He has militaristic control because of his political rank, but mm-hmm. you know, this is Grand Admiral Thrawn, you know, the same way later on we'll get Grand Admiral Sloan. So you know, there has to be something about Thrawn. It could be whatever was discussed in the Thrawn novel. It can be whatever is to be discussed now. And I'm also sure that there's a lot of people who fail that Palpatine does not care about. And a lot of that's kind of shown in Twilight Company, which is a surprisingly good novel.
I really like Twilight Company.
Yeah, that was I read that last year. It's pretty good.
Tim, any other thoughts on your favorite character here? Do you have any hopes of what you're going to see in this or read in this book?
I'm really excited to see where it goes. The thing is that in this current canon, we still need to explore Thrawn more. The books that were written, which are now part of Legends, are great source material, but they are not to be considered canon. Obviously, they've been drawn on quite a bit to kind of redevelop the character mm-hmm. of Thrawn for the current canon. But I'm excited to see something that's going to continue developing the character a little bit more. Like I mentioned a few episodes back when we talked about the end of Rebels, it is the Thrawn that we saw in Rebels is not the Thrawn that we know from Star Wars literature.
Right.
He's been softened a lot. It's a kid's show. He was set up to be a foil to our heroes, but not an insurmountable foil. Whereas the Thrawn that we know from the Legends books is a serious badass who is not to be messed with. And you're pretty darn lucky if you're able to overcome his genius. And I think a lot of that was brought in the first Thrawn novel that was done in this new canon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping that they're going to continue exploring that. I'm hoping that Thrawn is going to get a better understanding of the Force by working with Vader. I think that that's really key, particularly when, you know, with what was set up from the end of Rebels that Thrawn is now going to be teamed up with Ezra in the new film trilogy that Rian Johnson is writing.
Oh, Tim.
So, so Thrawn has to have a good understanding of the Force, and I think that his work with Vader is going to give him a better understanding of the Force. So I'm hoping that we see some good dialogue and some good understanding there. Now, beyond all that stuff, the cool tie-in here is that in the excerpt, they mention the planet of Batu. And when I read that, I'm like, I know this planet from somewhere. Where the hell do I know this planet from? So, but I could not draw it out of my brain. I had to Google it. And Batu is the name of the location that's been given for Galaxy's Edge, which is the new immersive theme park that Disney is going to be doing. So I think that's kind of cool that they're also making that connection and they're giving Galaxy's Edge a little bit of context and background. So I like that too. I don't think that has to be huge, but I think it is going to be a little mysterious. It is on the edge of the known galaxy, the edge of the known universe. And I think that's going to be some type of an anchor point to this other stuff that Thrawn's been talking about, this external threat.
Well, you know, by placing it out there on the edge of known space and so forth, it makes it so now you've got a whole adjacent section of stuff that we can bring in that we've never seen before. It makes it easier to bring in new ideas and new concepts without having to, you know, rewrite everything you've had in the past.
Yeah.
And if they can play off this and have the theme parks work with the movies, work with the books, hey, I'm all for that. And instead of making the theme park a unknown, unnamed planet that we've never heard of before, make it something that you've seen, you know, in an upcoming movie or in this book and go, yeah, okay. I feel like I'm in the novel I just read, and that makes it feel even that much more legitimate.
Yep, totally agree.
Speaking of understanding the Force, let's get into our second discussion topic here. I have recently rewatched these. Tim, did you get a chance to rewatch the Immortus trilogy?
This weekend, I had to. Knowing that this discussion was coming up, I had to jump into them. I had to rewatch them.
Yeah, it had been several years since they were on. That's the last time I saw them.
Yeah.
So it was good to go back and rewatch these things, especially with the events that we had take place at the end of Rebels. Now, did you fill our guests in that they were going to be discussing this tonight?
Well, Josh certainly knows because he knows that we're going to like stick in with all the questions on this because he is our Mortis pro.
Nice. So I can just sit back and relax and let Josh take over. Okay, so the Mortis trilogy is three episodes in the middle of season three of Clone Wars. It was Overlords, The Altar of Mortis, and Ghost of Mortis.
Was there any other time, Josh, that Mortis was mentioned or referenced beyond this stuff?
There was one time, and I typically rewatch the Yoda saga at the end of Clone Wars because it's probably my second favorite story arc after Mortis. There's one reference in, I think the episode is called Voices, and it's Yoda's outside in the garden at the temple, and he is hearing Qui-Gon's voice. Anakin walks outside the garden. Anakin also hears Qui-Gon's voice for a second, dismisses it, and Yoda immediately asks him, "Can you recount to me what happened on Mortis when you thought that you were speaking to Qui-Gon?" That's the only reference that you get.
Okay.
It happens, you know, three seasons after or two and a half seasons after. And so you have a lot of people who just they look at Mortis and they think, "Oh, Mortis didn't happen." And they say that because there's no reference to Mortis, you know. And I could understand that, but it really does sort of fall under the radar until this one moment. And again, you have a trilogy of episodes that deal greatly with the Force and the philosophy of the Force. And then you have the Yoda saga, which is all about the Force in a whole different, you know, direction. Mm-hmm. So I think it's interesting that those two are tied, if by nothing else, a single line of dialogue.
So let me ask you this then, Josh. So the ending of Rebels, where we go back to some of these topics again, does that legitimize what we had in the Mortis trilogy? Because there is that concept of, did this really even happen?
For me, I believe it does. I think there's a line that Palpatine says in Wolves and a Door where, oh God, what is this guy's name? Magistrate Hayden or something like that?
Yes.
He's talking about the big mural that's on Lothal, and Palpatine says the Mortis gods. And I think he says a line after that that's there have been instances of this found in the Jedi records. That tells me right there, this is not the first time that in some capacity, whether it is in a physical way or in some sort of imagery, that the family of Mortis has made an appearance in the galaxy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, I don't want to put it akin to something like an alien abduction that, you know, it happens every now and then, you know, people have these ideas and, oh, you know, it doesn't happen. Aliens don't exist. but that's, you know, that's how it sort of comes across in Rebels, where there are extremely old records of some sort of interaction with three beings of, you know, immense affinity to the Force. Mm-hmm. And the Jedi have recorded them over the past couple of millennia. So I see no reason to believe it didn't happen, but I could understand where, you know, people, where viewers want to see this as simply allegorical.
Now, my question, there were just so much similarity that I saw and heard when you heard the son speak. There was so much that was, in some cases, even word for word quotes that we've heard Palpatine say, which was pretty striking. And then visually, particularly when we make a comparison between the Mortis arc and things that we saw in Rebels, the Inquisitors look an awful lot like the sun. Mm-hmm. I mean, darn near like they followed a pattern. What are your thoughts on those things?
I think that there's an artistic style that follows individuals of the dark side, mm-hmm. At least in the current canon. You see it with the sun, you see it with the Sith, the Inquisitors, and to some degree you see it with the Night Sisters and the other Dathomirians throughout Clone Wars. There's a lot of pale white, a lot of red, a lot of black. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just the identifier of, you know, these individuals are aligned with the dark side. Okay. I 100% agree. The Grand Inquisitor, you know, when I first saw him, also at New York Comic Con, I was at the panel where Pablo Hidalgo was like, hey, we're gonna have a new show, it's gonna be called Rebels, and you know, but when I first saw that image, I was like, wow, he looks a lot like, you know, the sun, but he's a Uta Pawin, and you know, mm-hmm. this is a, you know, so I want to say it's something as simple as, you know, they liked the design fit, you know, it was dark, menacing. You had no confusion at all as to what side these individuals were on.
Right.
Yeah.
So you think it was really just more like iconography, and they just wanted that visual reference point.
Yeah. And I feel like you could even say the same thing about Asajj Ventress, her original, in the Gendi series for Clone Wars, her original mm-hmm. outfit, you know, she had this long white dress that ended off in a black skirt. Herself, she's pale skinned. When they transferred that over to Clone Wars, she looked very similar. Even when she was that intermediate period when she redressed herself in her Night Sister robes, it was still, you know, the same color, this deep red, you know, her pale face, everything. So it's all part of the style, I think.
Okay.
You know, Tim, you bring up a good question there with the whole imagery of what the dark side looks like. But the daughter didn't have the same kind of ties to the light side, man. Not that we have much to tie her to. You know, the imagery of the dark side in the Sith is very iconic and very easy to pick out. But having, and I think that having him look the way he did, and I guess going back and looking at it now after the fact, we had so much more since then, feels almost like it was cheap compared to what we saw from her. She doesn't really have any place to fit in with, unless I'm missing something. Was her outfit, was her stylization any reminiscent of anything else that I'm missing?
Nothing that I can think of. I mean, aside from the fact that she like truly radiated light.
Right.
which was certainly a big visual cue from her. But there's nothing necessarily that I'm aware of that really related to anything else in the light side that we know. And Nikki, did you get to rewatch some of Mortis?
Just a bit.
So, you know, I did, going back and watching this since it was, you know, what, several years since we watched it the first time, I thought it was a much better episode than I originally thought it was back when I watched it. And I'm not sure why. I mean, I think I should have remembered it and liked it better from what I remember from the beginning, but I didn't watch Clone Wars all over again, tell you the truth, now that I've seen Mortis again. Aside from the fact that the animation is a little bit less than what I'm used to seeing in Rebels.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go back and experience the storylines again and really kind of make sure I dive into this and make sure I have more of this in my head better.
Yeah. I've rewatching it, Lou, I think I kind of had the same impression that you did, that I found it much more interesting and much more, it drew me in a lot more than when I had originally seen it X number of years ago. And I know I didn't just see it when it first came out. I know I've watched it maybe a couple times since, but maybe because of this connection to Rebels, it kind of resonated with me a little bit more and I was more drawn into it. And I really looked at a lot of the symbolism and I was able to see some of the grander character arcs, particularly with Ahsoka.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously Anakin's was very heavy handed and, you know, they're smacking you upside the head.
Yeah.
With, this is what you're going to become, you idiot. This is what you're going to become. And, you know, all the Chosen One stuff and everything associated with that. And you know, that was just so apparent. But the stuff that we saw with Ahsoka, particularly where we know where her arc, her story arc went, when we got to the end of Rebels, it was very, I really liked how they tied that stuff in. And we got to see an adult Ahsoka in this arc, and we know the adult Ahsoka from Rebels, and you know, obviously when they did Rebels, they had a reference, they were directly making some references back to the vision of the adult Ahsoka that we saw in Mortis.
Mm-hmm.
Because they wanted that to hold true. They wanted those lessons learned, excuse me, that she had to really be applicable. And even though it was just a brief bit, it was very strong. It was very tied together.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that for me, when I first watched Clone Wars felt like more of a kid's show than Rebels did to me.
Yeah.
And now that I've had the whole completion of Rebels, going back and watching Clone Wars with a different eye might make me appreciate it even more.
So I think part of that was there was a stark tonal shift in Clone Wars, where the first two seasons had the first two seasons had all of these random episodes that were happening, out of order, and most of them were sort of these one-off episodes. And very quickly, just to go back, Lou, you were commenting on the visuals of the daughter. If you look up an angel in Star Wars, that was the first thing that I, like, now that we were talking about it, I was like, well, you know, I've seen this sort of glow and a different character in Clone Wars before. That can bring me down a whole other rabbit hole that we're not talking about today. there was a big tonal difference in seasons one and seasons two. And everything was a bit more relaxed. And then in season three, it happened around the middle of season three. It coincided with the 2-year time gap that happens. And your only visual indicator of this is Ahsoka. She physically looks more mature. Her dress changes, her attitude changes. And I think it's the first time that they go to Mandalore or something like that as well, or second time. But that's when everything shifts. You know, you have these next couple episodes, then you have Mortis, you have the Citadel where, you know, you first meet Tarkin, and then everything just, you know, the end of season three, I think, is with Savage Opress, and he's going to go look for Maul and everything. So the whole, like, tone of the show shifts after, you know, the middle of season three. And that's typically where people say the show gets a lot better. So I definitely understand what you're saying. You know, it it seems like it's hitting a target child demographic, you know. But I feel the same way about Rebels, at least most of season one of Rebels until the very end with that three-parter, where it's like, okay, well, you know, I don't think anybody needs a show to be more mature. You know, I don't think we all needed to see the Inquisitor decapitate those two guys in one episode, you know, for us to understand it's become a more serious show, you know. But yeah, it's an evolution of things.
Okay. Tim, any thoughts from you on Mortis and how it ties back into what we saw at the end of Rebels?
Well, I mean, obviously we have the symbolism of the father, the daughter, and the son that are found at the Jedi Temple on Lothal, and that gives us an indication, since I don't think we've seen this symbolism anyplace else. That gives us a really strong indication that since Mortis itself was a place very strong in the Force, that now seeing the symbolism of those three at the temple on Lothal gives us a really strong indication that that temple is an incredibly powerful place. And it was. We saw this. When they got into the temple, we saw this kind of rift of time and space, which seemed very chaotic. But I'm sure that with some time and some understanding and some incredible ability to use the Force and to figure this out, that it could be, I don't know if it could be controlled, but probably understood better. And better utilized, be it for good or otherwise. I like that they made this connection, particularly because the meaning, I think, of the father, the daughter, and the son, and what they represent in the Force and the amount of power that they had was not just dropped after this trilogy. And I hope that we see some additional reflection on this later on somewhere in Star Wars. I hope it continues to come up, because I think it is there's some really strong stories to be told here. It's obviously this really strong connection to the Force. The story that was told there just in this particular arc was pretty incredible, with the father knowing that he was going to die, wanting Anakin as the chosen one to take over for him, Anakin showing his power and his ability to, I don't know that he, that we can say he necessarily defeated the daughter and the son, but he forced them to let go of Ahsoka and Obi-Wan when they had each one of them captured when they were in their animal forms, and got them to actually kneel in front of him, which was also a very interesting thing. That's it, not a very Jedi thing. It was a very Sith thing for Anakin to do. So we really saw Anakin venturing significantly toward the dark side in this, even absent, even before he was kind of being heavily influenced by the sun. So we're just seeing Anakin continuing to track toward the dark side, and that was pretty heavily done here. And of course, you know, Anakin's story overall is one that is altruistic. He always thinks he's doing the right thing, yet his emotions get the best of him. And they certainly got the best of him in this, which is what allowed the son really to have so much influence over him. And fortunately, he was saved by the father. And the memories of his visions of the future were then wiped from his head.
That was a point where it was like, oh, it's too bad he didn't retain any of that, you know. But to your point earlier, Tim, I love the way Anakin is always on the side of the right. He wants to do the right thing. He wants to make sure he's doing things for the good of the galaxy, but it just goes horribly wrong. Whether it's him being selfish or it's him being manipulated, but it is always him, you know, we're going to do this and we're going to save people's lives, or we're going to, you know, we're going to bring justice. It's like, wow, he really wants to, and it just goes horribly wrong.
Yep.
So,
yeah, there's a lot to be told there. I think this is a rabbit hole that can just go so much deeper, and I'd love to be able to explain more of it. I know that we have some intent of doing a little random chatter theater, watching these three episodes. Hopefully Josh will be able to join us there too. And
yeah,
help us kind of explore some of this. Cause I know that, like, there's just so much to get into with this. And I know, you know, Josh has spent a lot of time kind of studying a lot of this and analyzing it, even just beyond these three episodes. And, I think there's a lot of good discussion to have about it. It's just, it sometimes I think seems tough for us to right now to just kind of encapsulate all of this without really specifically looking at the story and picking apart a lot of individual pieces.
Well, so we don't go down that rabbit hole. Is there anything that you want to bring up right now, Josh, that we've kind of glossed over that you think is important to talk about before we kind of end the discussion on Mortis? Without starting a 2-hour conversation.
No, I mean, you know, I understand the difficulty. I mean, I still try to, you know, I have different interpretations every time I watch Mortis, and I have some consistencies, and then there's other things that I am just picking up on now, and other things that I'm, you know, at complete odds with myself about. I think there's a couple interesting things with Mortis that never made it in. And I think that the one thing that most people know about, is that at some point George Lucas had the idea of the son having a council of characters with him. And one of them was going to be Darth Bane and the other one was going to be Darth Revan. These characters even got up into the character modeling stage.
Interesting.
You can go on Wikipedia and StarWars.com, and you can see the character models. And, you know, the idea in including them was not only are they obviously fan favorites, but they are characters who at the time were well known for being these deep thinkers of the Force, you know, be it for good or ill.
Sure.
And the only reason that George Lucas didn't approve the use of them was because he didn't want a character as powerful and dignified as the son to be lowered to needing the counsel of lesser characters, and not lesser characters as, you know, they are lesser characters, but the son is basically a demigod, you know, and for all intents and purposes. And so it's better to subtly show the influence of the dark side over him, despite his natural affinity towards the dark side, as opposed to him looking like he becomes a student to, you know, these Sith spirits.
Right.
That was a whole other thing that neither George Lucas nor Dave Filoni liked. They didn't like the idea of the Sith having some sort of immortality, be it in Mortis or in some other fashion. Because that's the whole point of the Sith. You know, they are selfish and they want to preserve their own life.
Sure.
So, you know, that's that. And then, you know, there's tons of different things that show up and things that come across in Rebels. I say if anybody is really interested in reading into Mortis some more, I say just rewatch Mortis. it's like the worst homework to give someone, because they're going to sit there and going to be like, I don't understand what is going on right now. And they're going to watch it like four or five more times and be like, God, that makes so much sense now. but I say these are like go-to things to rewatch. Rewatch Mortis trilogy. Rewatch the Yoda trilogy. The Yoda trilogy is just an amazing sort of look at the Force. And it gives us a better...
trilogy's trippy. It's like Yoda's on meth or something through half of it. It's but pretty Yoda's, trippy.
The trippiness of the Yoda trilogy is only really surpassed by the Mortis trilogy. but no, and definitely in Destiny and Sacrifice, the last two episodes of that trilogy, you know, there's things happening. Yoda's fighting like his would-be evil version, and he's, you know, being guided by these six beings that exist that don't exist. You know, there's understanding of the priestesses is, you know, it's there's a lot in that, and it's a bit clearer than in Mortis. But you know, watch Mortis, watch the Yoda trilogy. I could probably make a more comprehensive list, and I don't know it now. but there's certain episodes in Rebels that you should watch, not the least of which obviously being Wolves and a Door in a World Between Worlds. Basically, any episode that deals with the temple on Lothal, that's an episode that you should watch.
Which we saw both early on in the series and then later in the series.
Right.
Yeah. And I think there's... I think there's one episode in every season, that at least one episode in every season that has the Lothal Temple.
Okay.
Because there's an episode in season one. That's the first time that Ezra gets his Kyber crystal. That's the first time that That's the first time that we see Yoda as a character in Rebels. He looked terrible, but we're just
going to do it.
And it sort of works with whatever Dave Filoni was talking about, how, you know, this world between worlds has always existed, and it's where characters sort of meet without thinking. I typically agree a lot with Dave Filoni. I don't agree with him on that. there's an episode in season two, fantastic episode in season two, where Kanan, Ezra, and Ahsoka go to the temple to meditate on how to prepare to deal with Vader. It's the episode where Ahsoka learns the truth, or at least accepts the truth about Vader.
Yep.
It's the episode where that's the episode where we actually first see Yoda, because that's the episode where Ezra and Yoda have this conversation on the what would be the true nature of the Jedi and how they should conduct themselves.
Sure.
It's where Yoda says, you know, it's how Jedi choose to fight that matters. And it's the episode that Kanan gets knighted. Why? What? We don't know, because he could have been knighted by the Force. He could have been knighted by X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
You know, and then, yeah, and then there's Wolves in the Door, War Between Worlds. All these episodes in some way will connect. And people who want to have a lot of fun, just watch every Clone Wars episode after Mortis. And try to spot how many times you see the Convor, because the Convor only shows up after Mortis. And that, of course, goes into Ahsoka's storyline.
Sure, sure. Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff, I think, worth rewatching now, especially knowing what we know now. It makes it more exciting to go back and rewatch this stuff and see some of that symbolism and what was carried over. So it's really good. It is a heck of a rabbit hole. So, but I think we should, we've been going a while, so we probably should wrap up.
Yeah, I think we're going to end this episode now and bring this thing to a close and close the last doors down. If anybody wants to get a hold of us, the best way to do that would be sending us an email. You can send the email to echobase@randomchatter.com. You can find us online as well. Twitter is the best way to get a hold of us online, Twitter and Instagram, actually. Echobase Podcast is the Twitter handle for the show. Random Chatter is the Twitter handle for the network itself. You can find me on Twitter as @LouSecki. That's LouSecki. Tim, where can they find you on Twitter?
At Qui-Gon Tim. That's Tim with two M's.
And Josh, where are you on Twitter? Do you want to share your handle?
Yeah, I am at Chatting Myth. Talk to me anytime about any type of mythology. I'm here.
Awesome.
Cool.
We have an Instagram account for the network, too. It's Outer Rim Network on Instagram. And, of course, you can find all of our shows over at randomchatter.com.
Great. Let's see. We did, by the way, for those who might be wondering, we did lose Nikki. She had to jump out. I think she had a family commitment, so... We've had to continue on without her. So we definitely do appreciate for folks to spread the word and support us. Definitely, you know, word of mouth is a huge thing for podcasts. It definitely helps. Tell your friends, your family, your coworkers, anyone you know who likes Star Wars to check us out. Certainly leaving us some reviews on places like iTunes, Stitcher, wherever it is that you get your podcasts. Click on all the stars, write in some stuff about us that can kind of, you know, give folks a reason to at least check us out. And hopefully once they sample us, they like us. And certainly some financial support. You can hit us up on Patreon, randomchatter.com/Patreon. We definitely appreciate any contribution that you can make. Minimum contribution over at Patreon is $1 a month. And for every contribution you make to us, we give you something back. So that $1 a month, we'll get you full access to our Discord community, which is where you can find all of our hosts and a lot of our fans and listeners there. You can talk to us about various topical things, like we have show-specific rooms. We have rooms for television in general. We have rooms for movies in general. We have rooms for specific TV shows and specific movies. We have them about food and family and pets and all sorts of things that all of us have in our lives. And it's a lot of fun, and there's usually always someone on and interested to talk about something. So if you aren't sure about making that commitment through Patreon, you want to see what Discord is all about, head over to randomchatter.com/Discord. You can create an account in Discord, and you can join us in our public lobby. That one's free. If you are interested possibly in contributing more than that $1 a month, you get up to $5 a month, $10 a month, $15 a month. Again, we continue to give back to you. So you still get full access to Discord, and then you get access to other things like exclusive content, early releases to shows, and that kind of stuff. And if you want to throw us $1,000 a month, we will send Josh to you, and Josh can sit down with you and talk to you all about the Mortis arc and mythology as a whole. So that's our gift to you. We will send you Josh. We will actually pimp Josh out, because that's how
it's because you can't afford me.
You can rent Josh. The music you hear in this podcast is the Imperial March by Cell Dweller and the Force theme by Scandroid.
And that's about all we have for tonight. So thanks again for listening. Josh, thank you very much for joining us. It was great having you on. We'll have to do it again sometime. And unfortunately, Nikki had to run, but we'll have her back again some point soon. At this point, we're going to close the blast doors, and we'll see you guys in about a week.